Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Hey, Mom! 12-year-old Benji called out from the stairwell. Some guys in uniforms are getting out of a car in front of our house. Should I let them in? Oh, my God. His mother came racing up the stairs from the basement, unfolded laundry still in her arms. Oh, my God! She dumped the laundry in the nearest chair and then collapsed on top of it. Let them in! She commanded her son. Two army officers entered, removing their hats and extending their hands.
Mrs. Collins, I'm Major Larkin, the first introduced himself. And I'm so sorry to have to tell you.
Benji's mom felt her knees grow weak as she slid uncontrollably into blackness. When she regained consciousness, she thought of Benji standing next to her, a mute witness to both her loss and his own.
Oh, Benji, she began, your brother loved you so. I know you're sad. We're all sad.
Benji's eyes began to fill with tears, and he ran out of the room. Soon the kitchen door slammed behind him.
Oh,
Mrs. Collins just looked blankly at her visitors.
What do I do now?
From a parent's perspective, what should we know about tragedy assistance for survivors in the U.S. military? I'm Sandy Burt. Linda Perlis could not be with us today. She'll join us on our next show. Our guest today knows an awful lot about supporting survivors of tragedy in the military. Bonnie Carroll has recently returned from serving in Baghdad, Iraq, as the Deputy Senior Advisor for Programs in the Ministry of Communications. She is a past president of TAPS, Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors, the National Veterans Service Organization, providing peer support, grief counseling referral, casualty casework assistance, and crisis intervention for all those affected by the death of a loved one serving in the U.S. Armed Forces. Mrs. Carroll founded TAPS following the death of her husband, Brigadier General Tom Carroll, in an Army C-12 plane crash in 1992. She is a trained critical incident stress debriefer, a member of the International Society for Traumatic Stress Studies, and former chairman of the Military Committee for the American Association for Death Education and Counseling. She is also a major in the Air Force Reserve. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Bonnie.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
When tragedy happens in a military family, what is the first thing that happens? We've all seen the movies where the uniformed serviceman shows up with a telegram, just like in our story.
Well, today we live in an age of instant communications, and often the first notification that a family gets is over the mass media.
Oh, good grief. That must be even more difficult than this other scenario.
It is very, very difficult. We had a case up in Alaska where an AWACS plane crashed on takeoff, and many of the children were aboard a school bus that was just going by and actually saw it happen. So that was just incredibly difficult. But that particular crash happened at 7:47 in the morning, to give you an idea how quickly things turn around in the media. It was the lead story on CNN at 8 o'clock, 13 minutes later. And family members were calling from halfway across the country and actually then being the notifiers, as it turned out, to quite a few of those families. 24 were killed in that crash.
Oh, my goodness. So in a situation like that, is there backup? Do people come to the house and talk to the survivors and that kind of stuff? It's just after rather than as a prelude.
Absolutely. The military does a fantastic job, a truly beautiful job of honoring the life and the service of those who die in a number of ways, and the first of which is in the way they present the death notification. It is a time-honored tradition that is taken very, very seriously by the military corps, and it's done very carefully. They must absolutely confirm the identity of the deceased before they go to the house, understandably, which can lead to a many, many hour time lag between the news being on television. It's understandable, but it's very difficult for the family.
The family is sort of by themselves or with their loved ones or whatever, but without official military support during that little lag period.
That's correct. In my own case, when my husband's plane went down, I had kind of three notifications. One was that the plane was missing. Then as we waited, you know, kind of getting an update on the status. And Then finally, the third notification was when they did find the plane and confirm the identities of those who were aboard and killed.
So did they give you a phone call first, we're so sorry the plane is missing, or did they show up at your house and say, you know, the plane is missing? How did that work?
Well, in that case, they actually came to my office, which was tough. The colonel who did it was my husband's chief of staff, and he was compassionate, he was factual, and I couldn't have asked for a more wonderful person to be there at that moment in time to be reassuring and get me moving forward to where I needed to be.
Are they different with the parents of somebody who's lost than they are with the spouses? Do they make two visits?
Well, the military recognizes one next of kin, a primary next of kin. And that can either be a parent, if that's the service member's next of kin, or if there is a spouse, it would be the spouse. And the spouse can elect whether they will tell the parents or whether they would like to ask the military to do that for them.
Will the military make a second visit if they go to the spouse and the spouse says, by the way, would you please visit my husband's family?
Absolutely. Now, I certainly can't speak for the armed forces, but as an Air Force Reserve officer, I served 2 years as Chief of Casualty Operations down in San Antonio at the headquarters there. And I know the Air Force is absolutely wonderful about doing whatever the family would like within the bounds of reason. And oftentimes, that second notification would be made.
We've talked about sort of the normal scenario. Is there anything else that you would want to add to sort of what happened so we get a picture?
Well, there is. We have an awful lot of young families. The average age of those who die today in the military is 24. So their families are very young. If they're married, the wife may be 20 to 22. The children are tiny. And a consideration is made when the notification team goes out if there are children in the home, or at least it is in most cases, and accommodations are made to bring along people who can focus on the children. We had a circumstance several years ago that has been used to set this precedent, and it happened when a team went out to a young widow's home to do the notification. It was late at night. They were in the kitchen. Mom just completely broke down and is now going between very, very angry, very sad, sobbing, screaming. And the children wake up, come into the kitchen, and all they see are three men around their mom, who's hysterical, and they think she's being attacked. So it was very traumatic for these young children,
who now
are put in the position of thinking they have to save their mother. And a lot was learned, actually, from that particular circumstance, and now they do go out with additional personnel to just sit with the children, help them understand, do whatever the mom or the surviving parent would like if it's the death of a spouse or if it's the death of a child, of a sibling.
Is it significant in a situation like that they need to bring a female if a female's being notified?
The military notification teams conduct themselves in absolutely the most professional manner and are as trained as they can be in that urgent a situation. The composition of the team today is led by the commander, and he may have a medical person, he may have a chaplain accompany him, but it is his team, and they try to have the composition as appropriate as possible, but sometimes it's hard in rural America.
I can understand. We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion with Bonnie Carroll about helping survivors.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Bonnie Carroll today about helping survivors of military tragedy. What was different about the needs of families after the Pentagon attack on September 11, 2001?
Well, two of the factors that come into play in any military loss, but particularly a loss like 9/11, the massive trauma. I think society as a whole is traumatized, but for the family, it's a very personal horror that has occurred that they live with on a daily basis, particularly as the word came back regarding the remains that were recovered. This went on for 6 weeks as they went through the rubble. And then the public nature of the loss. As America grieves with the family, it's tremendously comforting, but it's also a very private time for the families. Taps was privileged to be at the Pentagon Family Assistance Center through that time, and it was a wonderful experience to be able to bring the children together who were there in the center and give them their own peer group, give them their own support system and coping tools. So that was very helpful. We also set up a child care center for the children, and it's amazing, even in idle play, the children there were building towers of blocks and knocking them over and working through their own grief in very subtle ways.
What kinds of services are especially geared to children that TAPS is providing?
One of the primary focuses of our children's program is the annual kids camp or youth gathering, and that has grown exponentially over the years. This year, in fact, we doubled in size. We just completed the 2004 youth gathering, and sadly, because of Iraq and Afghanistan, circumstances are such that the attendance was great. But the children at that gathering learn three things. They learn that they're not alone. They gain a peer network of their own age group, other children who have faced a similar traumatic loss, and can speak honestly and openly with them and talk through many of their own fears. They gain coping skills and learn how we honor those who serve and die in our armed forces.
Have you found that there's a difference in the responses and the learning curve and so forth based on the ages of the children, or is it based more on the kind of trauma that they've undergone?
With children in grief, certainly there is a very big difference depending on the age bracket. So our children are divided into groups by maybe even by each year, if not maybe each 2 years. But they're given different exercises to do that help them really explore what has happened and talk openly about it and validate and normalize what's occurred.
I've heard psychologists say that the younger a child is when there's a trauma, the deeper it hits. And I guess the child relives that trauma in different events as he or she goes through life. And I was just wondering how you see that working out in the camp situation.
We've had children who have come back now. We have one little boy who's been back for 8 years, and to see him grow over the years. And his ability now to share and to talk openly but to honor his father is profound. I mean, it has become a very strong part of his life. And instead of focusing these days on the trauma of what happened, he's able to share that, but he's able to focus on his father and the strong part he still plays in his life and the influence that he's been. It's been a very healing force to have his father's, his mentorship still today.
How do kids get chosen for this kind of camp, or is it a self-selecting kind of thing?
Sure, they are able to sign up and register. TAPS has a website at taps.org, and we have children come from all over the country, some from even coming from overseas. But it's just a wonderful gathering of hope and healing.
How long a program is this? Is it all summer or 2 weeks?
No, it's actually just a week over Memorial Day. So it's a very intensive program, but the kids do amazing exercises. One of the ones they did this year, which I thought was just incredible, the kids drew a red heart on construction paper and cut it out, and then they stood in a circle holding this heart, and all of these kids, just without saying a word, as they went around, would show how their heart felt. And some of the kids would hold this heart so tenderly, just very, very carefully protecting it. Other children would take it and wad it up and throw it on the ground and stomp on it. They felt they'd been trampled. And other kids would just tear it up into little tiny pieces and let it blow away in the wind. And it was gone. But in many, many ways, the children learn how we grieve and also how we heal and how we love.
So they're validating their feelings, first of all,
before
they can begin to heal.
An interesting part of the program, we have counselors who bring in then volunteers from the different honor guards. And these are the young men and women who do the burial detail day in and day out at Arlington. So these young men and women witness grief on a daily basis. We train them in traumatic loss in youth, and then they become mentors and kind of big brother, big sister to the kids one-on-one throughout the weekend, in addition to the counselors and in addition to their peer mentors. They have an awfully strong network that they establish.
A lot of support.
A lot.
What differences do you see between the grief responses and needs of military children versus civilian children?
Well, a death in the armed forces is unlike any other in our society in that many of the families will move away. They'll have to leave their base housing. They can't stay there indefinitely. The service member is now deceased. So for the child, they will move out of their school district. They'll move maybe far away, away from their friends. They'll leave their little, the safety of their bedroom, the room where Dad tucked them in at night and hung up their posters. And they will go into an area where they're just a kid without a mom or dad to come and watch them at soccer.
So it's a double loss.
It's a very complicated loss. We had one little boy whose dad had been Army Aviator of the Year. And he was, I think he was about 8 or 9 at the time, but his dad was the hottest thing on post. I mean, everybody knew who his dad was, knew who he was. He had a little matching leather flight jacket that he'd wear with pride, and it had all the same patches on it, and he was just it. And everybody at his little military school knew that he was it. And when Dad was killed shortly after that, a ward in a helicopter crash, and they moved away, they moved to an area with no military population at all. So this little boy suddenly lost his own identity. When his mom went to the parent-teacher night, the teacher said to her, well, it is awfully difficult after a tough divorce. And she said, well, now what makes you think I'm divorced? She said, well, that's what your son has said in school, because that was normal. And it wasn't until he came one year to this youth gathering, to the kids' camp, sitting around in a circle of all of these other little military children, that when it came to be his turn to speak, he talked about his dad. And he talked about what a cool guy he was.
And that was the first time he was
able
to. That
was the first time he'd really gone through what had occurred. And then he went right into the helicopter crash, and he said, and then he died. And all the other kids his age are nodding their head. They understood. And for him, that was his first validation that he wasn't alone, and that there might be some good way to remember Dad and to incorporate him.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion with Bonnie Carroll about helping survivors in the military. For an audio cassette copy of any Parent's Perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015. Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Bonnie Carroll about helping survivors in the military. We've talked about spouses and how children of people who are lost get support. What about parents of these young military people who then get killed?
That is a very large part of our population, the young parents of those who have died in the armed forces. We have a fellow named Lee Vincent, who is a key member of our parents' support group, and he wrote a beautiful letter, which includes this line, that regardless of the cause of death, our loved one, our child, had already risen far above the rest of our society in character, courage, honor, and ability. And not a moment of that achievement can ever be lost or taken back. And for our military parents, they have an exceptional amount of pride, as they rightly should. We focus on demonstrating that pride and honoring their loved one and that life, that it wasn't lost.
Do they have ways for parents of people who've been lost to get together?
We do have a national parent support group that is part of TAPS, and they do meet at the seminar and come together in their own support groups as well as with the rest of the program. It's a very, very strong part. It's unusual in our society to lose a child between the ages of 18 and 24, particularly a child who would be so exceptional, who would be physically fit, who would be at the peak of their performance, and who would be stepping forward to do something so profound for their country.
How significant is extended family in these situations? It sounds like it's major because the family is uprooted, so you need to have something that you can hang on to.
Absolutely. The extended family, the community is very, very important, and TAPS partners with many community-based organizations. So we can get the formerly military family back into a community environment of support.
So can you give examples of the connections that TAPS has with community-based organizations?
Absolutely. One of the strongest ones is through the Police Chaplains Network for Critical Incident Stress Debriefing and Crisis Intervention. Our crisis program in each state is really funneled through the Police Chaplains Association, and they know the different resources in their community doing traumatic grief, doing grief support groups. We also work with the National Funeral Directors Association, the National Cemetery System, the Association of Death Education and Counseling, but groups that have stable populations in a community and can help that newly arrived military family assimilate and find those resources.
So if a military family listening to this is now needing to relocate, what would be the first thing they should do when they get to a new community?
Well, TAPS actually will provide a good list of resources in a community, wherever it may be, of the grief counseling groups, crisis intervention resources, and things of that sort.
For people listening to this who are not military families, how can those of us who are not in the military help a military family who's grieving?
Honoring the life and the service, regardless of the cause of the death. Memorial Day is a wonderful time, particularly to do that. But throughout the year, to thank that family for their loved one's service, whether they died in Iraq or whether they died in a car accident or from a heart attack, the loved one in that family who has died had raised their right hand, had sworn to protect and defend the United States, and that life is precious to this nation.
Now, before we leave, what we need to do for military and non-military families is to give any resources that we possibly can so that people can take advantage of this.
Well, first of all, I'll tell you a little bit about TAPS as a National Military Survivor Program. It's primarily volunteer-based. The website is very simple. It's taps.org. The phone number is also simple, 800-959-TAPS. It's very basic. It's one-stop shopping, so to speak, what we set up for the families. It's one number where the families can call for peer support, for grief counseling referral, for crisis intervention, for casework assistance, help with benefits, and any other questions that may come up.
Now, how did you come to form this organization?
Well, when my husband was killed in 1992, I'd had a background working with national programs, ironically, of this sort, and went looking for the organization that was there. I knew had to be there for military families, but it didn't exist at that time. And I was very fortunate to find a small group of other military survivors who together founded TAPS. And we based it on the existing programs in our country and shamelessly borrowed, and with their blessing, the very best that they had done and what they'd done right. And they were also very nice about sharing what they would do differently. So the Department of Defense, Department of Veterans Affairs also shared with us where their services ended, and the other military widows groups shared with us what services they do not provide.
Well, Bonnie Carroll, thank you so very much for being with us and helping us to understand the grief process for military families and telling us a little bit about what your organization, TAPS, does. Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, Second Edition. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573. 8573 with your name and mailing address and mention show number 227. Tell us if you can what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Washington, D.C. with Kids is available at all major bookstores and on the web. To learn more about us and our book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. This is Sandy Burt. Linda Perlis will be with us next week. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.